Well, today in our series on every word in the book of Philippians, we are in verses 3 through 5 of the very first chapter. And what you see in the book of Philippians is that we are talking about an excellent church here. Like if you're looking at the books of 1st and 2nd Corinthians, you see lots of problems. Lots of corrections are necessary. Same with Colossians. They had some heresies going on there. Had some problems to correct, that sort of thing. Galatians, same thing. They had some legalism, some problems to correct. But not Philippians. Philippians, the only thing bad at all is that there are apparently two women, Euodia and Syntyche, and they're kind of not getting along too well. But except for that, the whole church is great, and Paul doesn't really have any reprimands, any corrections. He's just dealing with a great church. And this reminds me of how important the amazing, incredible bride of Christ, the Church of Jesus Christ, really is. So I want to give you fast version of how beautiful the bride of Christ is. I talk to you about this from time to time because it's so incredibly important. So here's our text today. I thank my God upon every remembrance of you. Again, just gushing. You're wonderful. You're my partners. You're great. You're serving the Lord. I thank my God upon every remembrance of you. Always, in every prayer of mine for you all, making requests with joy for your fellowship in the gospel, from the first day until now. So you see, it's like joy and remembering with gratitude and thankfulness to God because of the fellowship. Fellowship is warm partnership that we all have had together. It's just gushing with warmth and a bond between Paul and the church at Philippi. I want to remind you that the church is amazing. We live in an age when everybody sort of trash talks the church. But they shouldn't do that because the church is wonderful. And I want to remind you how the church changed the world in these 8 fantastic ways. Everything you like about life comes because of the influence of the religion of Jesus Christ on our world. So let me prove it. All right, the church and human rights. You like human rights, right? That's really important to you. All right. Justin Brierley says, secular historian Rodney Stark has argued that Christianity was the pivot point. What was? Christianity. Christianity was the pivot point that turned civilization in a radically new direction. From a culture in which many lives were regarded as cheap and expendable towards the valuing of every human life. You see, it just changed everything, the religion of Jesus Christ. Jordan Peterson says, the Christian doctrine elevated the individual soul, placing slave and master and commoner and nobleman alike on the same metaphysical footing, rendering them equal before God and the law. It is, in fact, nothing short of a miracle. That's the miracle of the religion of Jesus Christ. Let's talk about the family. Patrick Fagan, William Fitzgerald, in their research says, church attendance is the most important predictor of marital stability. What is church attendance? Wow. And Brad Wilcox says, compared to the average American family man, evangelical Protestant men who are married with children and attend church regularly spend more time with their children and their spouses. They're also more affectionate with their children and their spouses. The church changes the family everywhere in positive ways. Let's talk about societal ills and societal wellness. So Justin Brierley again. Research shows that people who regularly attend church report stronger social support networks and less depression. They smoke less. They have happier marriages and lead healthier and longer lives than people who don't go to church. Actively religious people are proven to give more money and time to charities, including secular charities, than non-religious people. They even donate more blood. Christians have changed the world, have changed society in good ways. Gunter Louis one time did not believe this, but he changed his views. He says, whether it be juvenile delinquency, adult crime, prejudice, out-of-wedlock births, or marital conflict and divorce, there is a significantly lower rate of such social ills among believing Christians. See, the church is it. The church is the greatest society that has ever been founded. It was founded by the Lord Jesus himself. David Byron Davis, who was an expert in abolition, is talking about the church's influence on doing away with slavery. He says, religion was the central concern, the most important thing, religion, was the central concern of all the British abolitionists. And just in case you don't realize this, in the 1800s, the religion of Britain that he's talking about was the Christian faith. So Christianity was the central concern of all the British abolitionists. And you notice the word all. He says, without that, the fall of New World slavery here, the fall of New World slavery could not have occurred. And this amounts to a moral achievement that may have no parallel. How did we ever do away with slavery? Christianity did it. Thomas Sowell, who is himself African American, he says the principal impetus for the abolition of slavery came first from very conservative religious activists, people who would today be called the religious right. Clearly, this story is not politically correct in today's terms. Hence, it is ignored as if it never happened. Why did we do away with slavery? How did abolition occur? It was from what you might call the religious right. So says Thomas Sowell. Dinesh D'Souza says, so who killed slavery? Why did slavery go away? Who killed slavery? He says the Christians did, while everyone else generally stood by and watched. Even the atheists admit that the anti-slavery movements in England and America were led by Christians. The beauty of the body of Christ. The church is like no other society that has ever existed in humanity. Let's talk about the church and its impact on education, which most of you have no idea how important this is. Keith Drury, professor of history, says, in 1830, the American Sunday School Union launched a program to establish a Sunday school in every destitute place west of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Volunteer Sunday school missionaries would head west to establish non-denominational Sunday schools. So do you understand? There were no Sunday schools. There was no schooling for children of any kind. So Christians decided that on Sunday they would go and teach the children how to read and write and do arithmetic. That's the Sunday school movement. It was actually a school. All right, so volunteer Sunday school missionaries would head west to establish non-denominational Sunday schools. They went from farm to farm recruiting children to come once a week on Sunday to learn to read and write and to study the Bible. Many of these women were the only school teachers in the community. They planted schools and educated the poor, teaching them to read and write, and used as their curriculum the Bible and the Ten Commandments. They intended to change the coming generation by raising up moral adults. When a community had an operating Sunday school, they eventually saw the need for more education than just the Sunday morning classes. Families banded together as a community to recruit a permanent teacher who could teach their children through the week. Sometimes this was the local Sunday school teacher. The Sunday school thus provided the kickstart for the development of the one-room schoolhouse. The school marm, almost always a single woman from the East, taught all week, but generally had the same aim as the Sunday school, teaching reading and writing and arithmetic in order to make solid Christian citizens of the coming generation. Many of the common schools started first with a Sunday school, then later developed into the one-room schoolhouse. So how did all of America learn to read? That was how America learned to read. And then, of course, the United States led the way in teaching the world how to read. That's why there is education in America and education around the world. Let's talk about democracy. You like democracy, right? Are you glad that you live in a place where there is government by consent? Where did that ever come from? That's the church, the religion of Jesus Christ. Chuck Colson says, prior to the English Reformation, 1500s, prior to the English Reformation, popular elections were unheard of. The concept of people electing their own leaders was first championed by the Puritans. By whom? The Puritans, Christians. So the concept of people electing their own leaders was first championed by the Puritans in the Church of England. And the Puritans came to the New World here to put their principles into practice because those principles weren't very well liked in the Old World in Britain. So they came here where they could really, really do it right. Historian Rebecca Fraser says, Plymouth Colony was the first experiment in consensual government in Western history between individuals with one another and not with a monarch. There was no king. That had never happened before. Not Greece, not Rome, not anywhere. Hubert Bancroft says, the first government of New England was formed on board the Mayflower before the landing of the Pilgrims. It was the democratic government of the Puritan church congregation, the Pilgrims choosing their governor as they chose their pastor by the voice of the congregation. Government by consent from the Christian faith. That's why America is what it is today. Let's talk about science. Justin Brierley says, there's another concept which the Christian worldview gifted the modern world, objective truth. Good and evil, truth, virtue, and purpose were real things, concrete facts about existence, not mere opinions. Such pivotal concepts are what science and moral progress were founded on. In other words, as long as you think that everything is just miraculous and you never know what's going to happen, maybe it worked one day, it won't work the next day, as long as you think that the gods are controlling your health and the weather and all of your experiments, you have no interest in experiments. C.S. Lewis said, men became scientific because they expected law in nature. And they expected law in nature because they believed in a legislator. In other words, we can do the experiment on Monday morning and we can do it again and get the same results on Wednesday night and the next Saturday and a year from now and 100 years from now, and we don't have to wonder if the gods are going to give us good luck or bad luck. There are the laws of nature and we can count on them. And that made science possible. Let's talk about the church in the whole world. This is my favorite quote from Robert Woodbury. He's a sociologist, and he wrote in the American Political Science Review, which is the most prestigious journal, academic journal in the field of social science. He says, the work of missionaries turns out to be the single largest factor in ensuring the health of nations. Areas where Protestant missionaries had a significant presence in the past are, on average, more economically developed today, with comparatively better health, lower infant mortality, lower corruption, greater literacy, higher educational attainment, especially for women, and more robust membership in non-governmental organizations. In other words, wherever the religion of Jesus went around the world, it improved those nations in every way. The church is amazing for all of those 8 reasons, and we could have said much more. So Paul says, looking at the church people in Philippi, he says, I thank my God upon every remembrance of you. You're wonderful. Always in every prayer of mine for you all, making requests with joy. Whenever I think about you, whenever I pray for you, I am just so happy. I'm making requests with joy. And the reason for that is for your fellowship in the gospel from the first day until now. Fellowship is warm partnership, right? So you've always been partnering with me. And the bride of Christ, the church of Jesus Christ, has always been partnering in the very best endeavors the world has ever seen. Let me show you a couple things I think are pretty special about that little section of Scripture. We're going to be talking about living in a way that makes it as easy as possible for others to value me and you as true brothers and sisters. We're going to live in that way. So notice what Paul says. I thank my God upon every remembrance of you. Every time I think of you, I'm just so thankful. Always in every prayer of mine with joy. I pray for you and it's always joy, joy. These are great people. They're wonderful. Verse 5, for your fellowship, your partnership in the gospel. It's been great. Years back, I read an article and a woman was writing about an incident from when she was 11 years old. Here's what she says. Leela is coming. Isn't that wonderful? That was the summer that I was 11 years old. Leela, my mother explained, is one of the most beautiful women I've ever seen. She was a teacher and a nurse. And always the Good Samaritan. It was 9 o'clock one morning. Leela breezed into our house. I stared at the long-awaited Leela, and my eyes popped. She was short, with a little stoop to her shoulders. Her sandy brown hair was streaked with white. But what was shocking was her mouth, with protruding jaw and uneven teeth. Her mouth was badly misshapen. And one day I asked her the question that was on my mind. Lila, I said, why are you so nice to everyone? And she smiled at me. Enid, you know I'm no beauty. One day I blurted out to my mother, why do I have to have such an ugly mouth? And mother gathered me in her arms. Remember always, she said, it is not the shape of a person's mouth that makes her beautiful. It's what comes out of her mouth that makes her beautiful or ugly. I'll promise you, if you let only kind words come through your mouth, you'll be the most beautiful person in the world. But you will need help, and God is always near to help you. Just remember to ask Him. Lila says, I have tried all my life to do just that. And that's why she was beautiful. Christian people, why are you so beautiful? Why are you so nice to everybody? Oh, well, that's the religion of Jesus Christ being worked out in our lives. And Paul says, you Philippian people, not just one of you, but all you Philippian Christians, you're just so good. Whenever I think of you, I feel joy, like what fine people these are. And I just feel so thankful that the Lord has allowed me to partner with you. I love to be with you. In October 1999, the Barron's Magazine was doing a survey because 1999, you know, we're looking forward to going into the new millennium, the year 2000 coming up. And so just, you know, on a lark, they were doing a survey of celebrity types and asking them what they would like to be if they could live their life all over again. What would you like to be in the next life if reincarnation were true? And they asked Senator Bob Dole at the time what he would like to be if you could come back again after you die and live again. What would you like to be? And he said, if I could live my life all over again, I would want to come back as the husband of Elizabeth Dole, you know, his wife. I would like to do it just like this. Do you realize what a compliment that is? Wouldn't you like to be married to someone who says, the best thing that could happen to me is to be married to you, and I would do it all over again exactly the same. And some of you are looking at each other and thinking the same thing, as my wife is as she looks at me. No, but it is true the other way around. All right, so Paul says, you're wonderful people. I just want to be with you. You're great. There's nothing that I would more prefer, and that's beautiful. Shortly after Robert C. McQuilkin's mother died, his fiancée, whom he would soon marry, Margie, wrote him a letter. And she talked about what a wonderful person he is. You know, the kind of person you would just thank God for every time you thought about him. Well, she says, you are 25 today, dear. For a quarter of a century, you have lived in the light of God's presence, led by His hand, guided by His finger. The comfort you have been from earliest childhood to your mother, she alone knows. The others have been comforts, but I knew what you meant to her from the first time she talked to me after we were engaged. You have meant so much to the rest of the family. Helen, sister, knew the thoughts of everyone and voiced the thoughts of the family when she said, Bob is the one who makes us happy. If I should try to tell you what these years of your life have meant to your friends, I should have to repeat a long, long list. You have touched them and left a blessing in their lives. Dearest, if I should try to tell you what these 3 years of your life have meant to me, the only vent I could find for my emotion would be in tears. See, Bob is the one who makes us happy. He's just such a dear person. Whenever I think of him, well, I just want to thank the Lord. Whenever I think of him, it's all joy. And that's the kind of person that Christians frequently are. And that's the kind of Christian you will be, I'm sure, as well. So Paul says that we should all appreciate the Philippians and we should try to be like them. We should also do what Paul did. We should focus our thoughts on the lovely qualities of others instead of their flaws. And that's very, very important. Remember our text says, I thank my God upon every remembrance of you. I wonder what he's remembering, because I'm sure they did some things that were very off-putting, right? But whenever I think of you, I thank God. Every remembrance of you, always, when, always, all the time, always in how many prayers? Every prayer, always in every prayer of mine for you all, I make my request with joy. I just think you're wonderful. I make my request with joy for your partnership in the gospel. You've been wonderful partners to me. Now, followers of Jesus will always be the kind of person that Paul was, where you're seeing the best in others. Because you have to know that as wonderful as the Philippian Christians were, and they were wonderful, they must have done some things that were not wonderful. Things that were off-putting. All of us, without exception, are so resistible. Nobody is irresistible, right? And the Philippian people weren't irresistible. So why is it that Paul can thank God for every memory of them? And why is it that Paul can have joy every time he thinks of them and prays for them? How does he do that? And the answer is, he's looking at the things that are lovely about them. So in Proverbs 17:9, he who covers a transgression seeks love. Do you understand that? There's a blanket of love that goes over our faults. And if you love somebody, you cover those faults in a blanket of love. Now that is what Paul had to do for the things that were off-putting about the Philippians. Because all of us have things that are resistible and off-putting. But it's okay. He loves, and so he covers that. And that is so necessary. Martin Luther, talking about the eighth commandment and commenting on 1 Corinthians 13:5-7, had some good things to say. 1 Corinthians 13:5 says, love thinks no evil. I'm not going to think badly of you. I do not just skip over all your good things and get to your bad things. Oppositely, I skip over your bad things and get to your good things. I get to your good qualities, the things that are true and lovely about you. I purposely skip over the bad things to get to those good things. You see? And then it says in verse 7, love believes all things. And you know, you can't believe everything that a person says, even if you love that person. But you want to believe it. You want to believe in the person. You want to believe what he says, and you want to believe that he is who he represents himself to be because you love him. So when you love a child and turns out that the child has been accused of doing something wrong, as a parent, because you love your child, your first impulse is to say, no, I don't want to believe that he did that. And you go to your child and say, please tell me that you didn't do that. And then they say, oh, yeah, I did that. Like, oh, but you see what you're doing? You wanted to believe the child. You wanted to believe in the child. And then eventually it became necessary to realize the child did something wrong. But that's what it is to love. And so if we're going to think no evil and we're going to believe the best about people, then we could look at even flawed people like the Philippian Christians were and say, I'm so thankful for you. All my memories of you are with joy. And so Martin Luther, having considered 1 Corinthians 13 as well as the eighth commandment about not bearing false witness, he said, we should fear and love God so that we may not deceitfully belie, that's deceive, so that we may not deceitfully belie, betray, slander, nor defame our neighbor, but defend him, speak well of him, and put the best construction on everything. See, that's what it is to love. I will defend. I will speak well. I'll put everything in the best possible light. See, that's what Paul was doing, and that's why even flawed people like the Philippian Christians could be loved so dearly. All good memories, all joy. Henry Ward Beecher said, every man ought to keep a fair-sized cemetery in which to bury the faults of his friends. That's so good. Love covers a multitude of transgressions. You can bury the bad things, the things that are off-putting and annoying about someone. You can bury all those things in love. And you ought to have a fairly big cemetery for that. Because if you are friends with the likes of me, you're going to have to bury a lot of things. So get a big cemetery. I love the Gottman Institute, which is not a Christian counseling organization. As a matter of fact, they say some things that are distinctively not Christian. And yet, they have somehow incorporated a lot of biblical wisdom into their counseling approach. And so John Gottman is talking about what is their approach for relationships, marriage in particular. He says, this means that for every negative interaction during conflict, a stable and happy marriage has 5 or more positive interactions. Okay, so you understand this during an uncomfortable discussion. This was negative, but there were these five things that were positive. It is important to remember that negativity holds a great deal of emotional power, which is why it takes five positive interactions to overcome any one negative interaction. Our motto for making marriage last is small things often. And how you treat each other outside of conflict influences how well you'll handle your inevitable disagreements. Those small gestures, a kind word to repair a hurt, a wink, a smile, a touch, an offer of a drink of water, etc., accumulate over time and will provide a buffer of positivity in your marriage so that when you do enter a conflict, it will be easier to engage in positive interaction that outweighs the negative. So you see, here's what we do. Your wife says, oh, look at the pretty bird out the window, and you don't look. That's a negative interaction. You didn't really even say anything, right? You just didn't care. You didn't look. Somebody does something nice for you, you don't really say anything. Somebody looks nice, but you don't say so. Somebody has encouraged you, but you don't say so. You have to have five positive interactions, which can be nonverbal, right? A touch. You walk past your spouse, but you don't touch your spouse. When you walk past your spouse, you're supposed to run your hand along her back or do something to say, I see you, I know you're here, it matters to me. And all of these are positive interactions. And five of these positive interactions will offset one bad thing that you do. The Philippian Christians weren't perfect. But Paul says, I am always thankful for you. Whenever I remember you with joy, because he had so many positive things in mind, and that provided a buffer for the negative. Joseph Stoll, former president of Moody Bible Institute, was talking when he exited and was no longer going to be president. He was talking about some of the criticisms that came to him. And, you know, sometimes a very large donor, for example, would say, I'm giving this money and now I want you to change Moody Bible Institute to be liberal or whatever. And they would get mad at him. People would get mad at him. And they said, so how did you handle that? People would criticize you in print, etc. How did you handle that? He says, remember, this is what he had to tell himself. Remember that you are just as broken and needy as the next guy, and permit that reality to drive you to the throne on a regular basis. Say, boy, that guy, he really upsets me. Don't do that. You should say, I realize that I am broken and I am needy, and that guy is really no different than I am, and make sure then that you're thinking about the things that are true and lovely. Because if we think about the things that are annoying and off-putting, then we will not pray for those people with joy. And our every remembrance of those people will not be with thanks. Now let's talk about this partnership. Nurturing an unbroken warmth and partnership in the service of the Savior. And this being mindful of the reality that warmth and cooperation are always fragile, and they require nurturing. So, you know what you tend to think? Oh, well, this relationship, my friendship is strong, and so I don't need to nurture it. My marriage is strong, so I don't need to nurture it. All children love their parents, so parents don't need to nurture that relationship. Oh, that's not good. You have to realize that all warmth, all bonding requires nurturing. It's always as fragile as spider silk. So again, Philippians 1:3, I thank my God upon every remembrance of you, always in every prayer of mine for you all, making requests with joy, and in yellow font there, for your fellowship, your warm partnership. You work together with me and you're bonded with me. I'm so thankful for that. And that has come from the first day until now. Just remember, the church at Philippi was started under duress. So imagine this. Paul has never brought the gospel. Nobody has ever brought the gospel to Europe before. And so Paul crosses from Asia Minor over there in what we call Turkey today, and he drops into the Greek peninsula. At the top of the Greek peninsula is Macedonia, and we call Macedonia today Europe. Philippi and Thessalonica are in Macedonia. Well, the gospel had never come to Europe before. So Paul brings it to Europe. What happens? immediately Lydia becomes a Christian. That's great. But then Paul is cast into prison with Silas, remember? And they beat him, and they put him in stocks, and there's an earthquake, and the prison doors bounce open, and Paul is able to witness to the jailer because of the miracle. So now we have Lydia and her family, and we have the jailer and his family. But it all started out with these baby Christians, brand new to the faith, and their hero, Paul, with Silas, their co-hero, in jail, having been beaten for what they've done. It's a rough start. Paul said, from the first day until now, Lydia, Philippian jailer, and your family, you all have been my warm partners. You always cared about us. You have always labored with us. And that's extraordinary. Norman Grubb ran the mission organization that C.T. Studd started. And, of course, missionaries tend to fail if they fail because they don't get along with each other. Think, no, that can't be true. Missionaries are so devoted to the Lord, I'm sure they get along with each other. But more often than not, if a missionary comes home from the mission field earlier than he told all of his family and friends he was going to come home, it's because of personality conflicts. So here is the president of a missionary organization, and he's talking to his people about how we can avoid these personality clashes that become so upsetting to us all. So here's what he said. In other words, the first great secret of maintaining unity is the moment I am inclined to criticize or resent a brother, I must recognize my spirit of criticism as the sin which concerns me. Why do I get so easily upset that I want to criticize? So it's the sin that concerns me and not my brother's behavior. And I must keep on letting God deal with it till a spirit of appreciative love replaces it, by which I honor my brother instead of judging him and rejoice in all the image of Christ to be seen in him. So you look at a Christian brother and you say, oh, here's what I don't like about him, and I also don't like this, and I also don't like this. But what you should be saying is, how is it that this person is able to do this? Because that's Christ's work in his heart. I see that, and I think that's just wonderful. And then you say, and you know what else? I think I see Christ's work in his life in this matter, and this matter, and this matter. And now your ill feelings are melting away. More Norman Grubb, slightly reworked. Two alternatives always present themselves to us. We can see at a glance what is offensive in our fellow believers. Sure, it's easy. Or we can see the outlines of Christ. We can choose to remain focused on the offenses of another person and point them out, and thus foster disunity and distrust, as well as emotional upset to our own souls. Or we can recognize in our fellow believers the divine image, which is at times so beautifully reflected in him. We can appreciate this and make it the subject of our comments, and thereby foster unity and confidence, as well as sweetness to our own souls. So you see, we could look at any person in this room and we could just pick them apart. Or we could see the work of Christ in them and appreciate that and talk about it amongst ourselves. And if we do that, we will thank God upon every remembrance of them, always in every prayer of ours for them. We would make requests with joy, and we would have that fellowship in the gospel, partnership, warm partnership, from first day until now, unbroken, lifelong partnership. I want to close with this fairly long reworking of A.W. Tozer's work called That Incredible Christian. It was a whole book, but the finale of the book was like this. But I don't want to talk about one incredible Christian or, you know, just generically all Christians are like this. I want to talk about the incredible church. So I'm going to rework it a little bit. And this is why you have to love the church. So here we go. That incredible church. Incredibly, the members of Christ's true church keep sacrificing their lives away for others, and yet their sacrifice makes them more alive than ever. They are crushed under the weight of divine tenderness, yet lifted higher and higher by the winds of unearthly love. They require no appreciation from anyone at all, but look forward to everlasting crowns from Christ himself. They feel nothing done against them, but then they protect everyone else from even the slightest emotional slights. They convinced their opponents by ceasing to dispute with them. And they went over their enemies by letting them have their way. They quickly confessed and renounced their own sins while hiding the faults of others under the covers of love. These Christians walked together on earth while being seated with Christ in heaven. And although they were born on earth, it is their citizenship in heaven that they truly treasure. No longer feeling quite at home in this world, they're irresistibly drawn to one another in their eagerness about that future world. The members of the Christian Brotherhood are confirmed pessimists when they speak of the cross and no hope at all outside of Christ. But then they are also bright-eyed optimists when they speak of the empty tomb and the sure triumph of good over evil after all. They have learned that to be victorious in this world, they must not follow the common pattern of humanity. So that they can be truly safe, they lay down their lives. So that they can be truly promoted, they slave away for others. They go down to get up. And if they refuse to go down, they're already down. But when they begin to go down, they're on their way up. The members of Christ's church are strongest when they're weak, and hopelessly weak when they feel strong. And while being infinitely deficient every day, they have the power to make everyone around them succeed. But when they become self-successful, they have no power to help anyone. They have the most when they have given the most away. But when they become rich, they have hardly anything at all. They're often highest when feeling most low, and most godly when feeling most embarrassed by their faults. They are most wise when they are most aware of their foolishness, and most foolish when they are most clever. Sometimes they do the most by doing nothing at all, and sometimes they go the farthest while standing still. They know they have been cleansed from sin, yet still refer to themselves as the chief of sinners. They love supremely one whom they've never even seen. These Christians do indeed fear God, but actually like to do so. They deeply feel His sweet and mighty terror, but there's no place they would rather be. They all gladly acknowledge that they are paupers, and yet feel free to converse warmly with the King of Kings in His own house at any time, day or night. They all know they are nothing, and yet they honestly believe they are the apple of Christ's eye and worth dying for. That incredible church. So the incredible Christian Brotherhood. People just like you who are easy to be bonded to. People just like you who cover over the flaws of others with their love. And people just like you who nurture lifelong warmth and partnership with all fellow believers. That's the Philippian church, and I know that's your heart too.